classical archaeologist here at UBC and have been invited to be president for the rest of the year. It's a great honor to be asked to do this and to follow in the footsteps of so many worthy predecessors. I'd just like to commemorate for a moment here the passing of a former president of ours earlier this month, Justice Peter Seaton, who served with great distinction on the board of the Vancouver Institute and as president several times. It is an interesting experience to come here and face the audience as a chairperson rather than as a speaker, as I was last year. But it's a great pleasure to have the possibility of beginning my career as president here with such a distinguished speaker as we have tonight. John Stubbs became Simon Fraser University's sixth president and vice chancellor on the 1st of October of 1993. Born in Sarnia, Ontario, Dr. Stubbs grew up in Edmonton after his family moved to Alberta in 1949. Educated at Trinity College at the University of Toronto, the London School of Economics, and St. Catharine's College, Oxford. He has had a very distinguished career in both administration and academics. He came to Simon Fraser from Trent University, where he was president and vice chancellor and professor of history. And he was telling me at dinner that he has managed to teach at least one course every year that he has been president. Very difficult job, as administrators, whom I see a considerable number here, well know. And he has also began his career in 1967 as assistant to the Master of Peter Robinson College and as lecturer in political studies at Trent. Mrs. Stubbs is, in fact, an alumna of Simon Fraser University and was a don there. Before becoming president of Trent University, however, Dr. Stubbs spent 14 years at the University of Waterloo as a faculty member in the history department and in various academic posts, including associate dean for special programs in the Faculty of Arts. He developed and directed the Applied Studies Cooperative Education Program, which places honors art students in four-month work placements alternated by study terms. He's also been active in the development of arts administration as a field for education and training. He was a major force in bringing the Oxford English Dictionary, the OED, project to the University of Waterloo, assembling a team of humanists and social scientists who worked with computer scientists to develop a database and related software to allow for the computerization of the OED. Now available both online and in CD-ROM format, the Oxford English Dictionary is regarded as the single richest source of the history and evolution of the English language. And it's becoming such a matter of course, not just for scholars and students, but even journalists. And I should mention our sponsor of the evening, this evening, the Vancouver Sun. In that context, I noticed in an editorial a week or two ago, the writer was referring to the value of the OED CD-ROM in composing his works. Professor Stubbs has also worked extensively with the Ministry of Colleges and Universities in Ontario, with the Ontario Council of University Affairs, which acts as a buffer, much needed these days, between universities and governments. Virtually all his recommendations on the future role of the Council were accepted and implemented, a wonderful thing for an academic administrator to achieve with a provincial government. Professor Stubbs has also played a leading role in fostering closer relations between colleges and universities in Ontario. His research and teaching interests in particular include British history since 1914, the history of journalism in Britain, and the application of computer technology to humanities research. He'll talk to us about that tonight, Dr. John Stubbs.
Well, I have to get geared up here just a minute. Well, let me begin by saying what a rare privilege it is to be here and to thank the Institute for the invitation to speak to you tonight, and also to thank Professor Williams for his very warm and reassuring introduction, reassuring to me anyways, and also for a very fine dinner before we got here. I would also like to acknowledge the sponsorship of the Vancouver Sun for this particular lecture. I'm delighted to know of this involvement, and I'm very appreciative. And finally, I'd like to thank Professor Peter Nemetz for talking me into doing this. This courtship has gone on ever since Simon Fraser started to court me for the presidency, and I'm very, very pleased to be here, and thank you very much, Peter, for the invitation. When you look over the list of individuals who have spoken to this organization, you can't help but get a bit nervous. It's a very distinguished and a very eclectic group. And so I approach it with some trepidation, and I want to lay out very, very briefly my approach. This is not a written formal text. I don't feel comfortable doing that. I feel much more comfortable working from notes. And it is also, I hasten to say, not a heavy academic treatise. Rather, I think it's a good story and a very, very interesting example of the relationship between a number of organizations in Canada and elsewhere who came together on a very particular project in the 1980s. It's also, of course, a particular delight for a president of Simon Fraser University to come on the campus of the University of British Columbia and to speak to, I'm sure, a goodly number of people who have UBC connections. I'm also reassured, though, by some SFU faces in the audience. And I want to say, as an opening comment, that as a family, we have covered our connections between the two universities in this city very wisely, I hope. My wife, Mei Ling, is a graduate of Simon Fraser and of UBC. I'm the president of Simon Fraser, and our son is a student at UBC. So we've tried to spread our bets around the neighborhood. As I said, I want to tell a story, and I think it's a very good story, which reflects very powerfully and very positively on a number of actors. The University of Waterloo, where I was at the time, and where I know certainly at least one or two people in this audience have also had associations. A very interesting university, one that I feel has very close affinities to a number of the things that go on here at UBC and certainly at Simon Fraser. The Oxford University Press, which I think is an exemplary publisher and a visionary organization in thinking ahead about what's coming in the field of publishing. The Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council of Canada, which, to our great delight at Waterloo, very powerfully supported this project, even though it was a project that on the surface appeared to be of more interest and more appeal to something like the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council, which in fact would not support the project, did not see the value of investing in the Oxford English Dictionary project. But NSERC did, and they deserve a great deal of credit for it. There were also a number of private organizations, in particular the Kinnear Foundation in Toronto, which put money into this project. I think another thing that's important about this, it shows that the university can operate in the real world very, very effectively, deliver the deliverables ahead of schedule, in fact, and certainly have met every expectation that was put on the University of Waterloo and my colleagues in this project. In every way, it was a great success. And particularly for me, as a historian and someone in the humanities, not a scientist, certainly not a computer scientist, it was very, very revealing to learn about the power of computing and to see the marriage of computing and the humanities, which 10 or 15 years ago, when this idea was being thought about, was something new and something very exciting. Before I launch formally into it, though, I do want to say something that I want to be explicit about, and that is that I was a co-director of this project. I worked very closely with two other colleagues, Professor Frank Tompa, who is now the chair of computer science at the University of Waterloo, and Professor Gaston Gonnet, who is now has left Waterloo and now lives in Switzerland. But for those of you who are in the field of mathematics or computing, was one of the principal figures in the development of MAPLE, a very, very powerful tool in this field. These are the two people who really ran the project. I was there for the ride, but it needs to be made very clear that they were the people who had the ideas, and in particular their students had the ideas that made this project such a success. The other thing that I want to say about working with Gaston and Frank was that I learned something that I had not learned in my first 15 years in the university, and that was that people in the sciences, or at least in computer science, were far cleverer than those of us in the humanities, because in fact they went to all their conferences during the week. And those of us in the humanities always went to conferences on weekends. I didn't know there was such a thing as an academic conference that was held during the week. But when I started to work with computer scientists and with other colleagues in the science faculties, I realized that I'd been missing something, and that in fact you could go to a conference, an academic conference, in the middle of the week. So that was one of my great lessons from this project. Let me begin. Many of you will know a good deal about the Oxford English Dictionary or have used it. And in particular, I commend to you a book by Elizabeth Murray called Caught in the Web of Words, which is about the putting together of the Oxford English Dictionary. Elizabeth Murray was the granddaughter of Sir James Murray, who was the man charged with putting together the Oxford English Dictionary. It was a laborious project. It was also a very, very interesting project, and a very typically, if I could say so, typically English project in how it all came about. And it is a topic for another lecture, but certainly one worth reading about. Elizabeth Murray. As you can see from the material, the first facsimile of the OED, which is the very first section of the OED, alphabetically, was published in 1884. There were great expectations that this entire project, which was to record the history of the English language, would be completed in some 20 years when the project began at the end of the 19th century. And again, as you can see, it took until 1933 to complete the project. James Murray was long gone, and a series of other individuals were involved in the project. Almost immediately on the completion, or indeed before the completion of the OED itself, it was clear that there would have to be a supplement to the OED because, of course, the language continues to change. and the language continues to grow. Language is not a static thing, and in addition to that, a great deal more evidence, supporting material for the dictionary came to light in the period as they were working on the closing supplements. But it took a very long time. The war, of course, interrupted the process at the Oxford University Press until the university was able, or until the press was able to find the resources to begin to prepare a supplement to the dictionary. And that preparation began in 1957 under the direction of a New Zealander, Robert Birchfield, who worked on the dictionary until about 5 years ago as the editor-in-chief of the OED. It took a further 30 years to complete the four supplements to bring it up to date again. But not surprisingly, we were then again behind because you begin with A and you end with Z, and the language keeps moving on. Moreover, the press lost about £1 million on the production of each volume of the supplement. So it was clear that the production of the supplements to the OED could not continue on commercial grounds, and it was also a decision relating to the state of the plates, the original plates from which the OED is printed. And I have some of the original 19th century plates. Each of us who were in the project were given a copy of the plates. And the plates are very worn because they've been run so many times. So there was a problem in addition to money. They would also have to recast the original plates for the dictionary. Why is the dictionary so important? Why is there such a major amount of attention and energy developed or paid to the dictionary? I think there are, all of us have our own reasons, but those who are experts in the field will tell us that it is, of course, the most complete historical record we have of the English language. There is in the dictionary, and I'll discuss the illustrated overhead a little further on, but there is the etymology of all the words that make it into the OED, and then there are massive strings of quotations to illustrate the use of the word, usually century by century, beginning as early as the 13th century. For example, if you look up the word set, S-E-T, the verb set, there are 154 definitions of the verb set in the OED. The text runs to 60,000 words and covers 150 pages in the dictionary. So we're talking about a very, very complete record of our language. And as a historian, that is very important to me. For people working in English and in other related areas, of course, it's absolutely fundamental. So from the perspective of Oxford University Press, in the late 70s and early 80s, there was a problem. And the problem was what to do next. How could they move on? As I indicated, the first volume of the supplement was already very dated. The costs of proceeding in the traditional editorial and hot metal process were seen as prohibitive at the time. And I think became even more so, and I'm not privy to all of the conversations that went on at OUP at this time, but everything that I've heard suggests that they were coming very close to dropping the dictionary. And the results, no matter how quickly they moved with a supplement, would still be dated. Every time you brought out a supplement, it would still be dated. So you would be going on and on and on. Very good for people who like dictionaries, not so good if you're in the business of producing dictionaries and trying to make money out of them, at least not the way they were doing it at that time. There really were two alternatives. One was, of course, to cease, to not produce anything more, so that the dictionary would in fact become a magnificent historical record of the way we looked at language between the late 19th century and the late 20th century, and would be very full and very complete, but it would come to an end. The other was to look at the computer, or to look at creating a machine-readable text for the OED. That was the other alternative, and it was an alternative that became increasingly attractive to people at the press in the late 70s and early 80s. What are we talking about? This is what we're talking about. The OED. It's very large. Most of us know it, unless we use it professionally, we know it through some of its variants, the shorter Oxford, the compact, the readers, the Book of the Month Club, which is known as the squint edition at Oxford University Press. Probably many of us have joined the Book of the Month Club to get the squint edition, to look through the magnifying glass. But as you can see, it's a very, very considerable text. Some 21,000 pages in 16 volumes, over 300,000 main entries and so on. You can read the material, but it is enormous and contains a massive amount of information. The question then, very clearly, was what are they going to do? This reflects some of the thinking at the press, and also some of the thinking as they became more involved, particularly with the University of Waterloo. They made a decision at some point in the early 80s, probably in 1981 or 82, to seriously explore the potential of computerizing the Oxford English Dictionary and not letting it become a historical document. Remember, we're talking about an era in computing, as far as the humanities are concerned, as far as computing in the area of text, that was fairly early. This is early in the game. But there were people there, and there were certainly people at Waterloo, and certainly the president of the University of Waterloo, Doug Wright, who was a major force in this, as I'll discuss in a moment, who had this sense that natural language computing would become a very, very big activity in the 1990s, and believed that a computer could manipulate and process words, data, in just as effectively as it could process numbers. There were also, at that time, a growing number of machine-readable databases, and the belief that you could link these machine-readable databases and draw on them. There were also a couple of other considerations here that are important, and I link information as a commodity and Oxford University Press as a commercial entity, because it's very, very important in understanding their thinking. The press is an enormously complex organization, part of the university, but also quite independent of the university, and of course has to stand on its own as a commercial activity. But for those of us who are academics and like to have our monographs and books published by the press needs the subsidy of commercial activity that actually generates them revenue. So the Bible, which is one of their major products, is an important one, and some of their dictionaries and a great deal of their reference material generate resources for the university. And for those of us in Canada who've tried to set up university presses with the same expectation, we know that it's a very, very difficult thing to do. But the press, OUP, is particularly acute and agile in this area. So they The recognition was that they could not afford to lose any more money in producing the OED in the old way. They should look at computing, and that if they tried to think about it further out, that there were possibilities that at the moment they couldn't achieve going about it in the then contemporary method. Also, there is a strong sense of pride in terms of the OED at Oxford, at the press. It is the historical record of the English language, and there is a sense of responsibility. And you see it when you meet the lexicographers in Oxford. They have a very strong sense that they, in fact, have a critical historical role to play in the preservation of the evolution of our language. And lastly, the recognition that English is commercially the international language and will increasingly become so. All of this fitted together in the thinking at the press. There were three broad objectives for Oxford when they made the decision to move ahead and seek out the possibilities of computerizing the dictionary. The first thing they wanted to do was solve the immediate problem that had driven them in this direction, and that was how could you integrate the supplement and the dictionary so that, in fact, you would end up with 16 volumes that actually fitted together instead of having to go from one volume to a supplement to see what had happened in the intervening years. And the request was that integration of the dictionary itself and the supplement for publication in printed form should occur by 1989. In fact, it was done in less than 5 years and was published as the second edition of the Oxford English Dictionary in March 1989. There would be, as they worked on the project, some editing to ensure common style, which of course had slipped over the period of nearly 100 years from the standards that Murray set with different hands involved. There was not a consistency despite the efforts of many, many proofreaders. There was also the concern to get the dictionary internally more consistent than it had been in the past, in particular to get the cross-references to line up. If you are a serious user of the dictionary, you begin to realize that in its earlier form, some of the cross-references were not noted. They would also want to supply missing information in the text of the dictionary itself, because there are thousands of people who write regularly. There may be some in this audience who write regularly to the dictionary department of Oxford University Press to draw to their attention some use of the language that usually irritates them, sometimes intrigues them, and sometimes is something that they've invented and they would like to see in the dictionary. But there is a continuous record kept of all of this information, and I've seen all the handwritten slips from the 19th century, which were then typed in the 20th century and which are now entered on computer as they come in. But there are literally thousands of people who write to the dictionary department regularly. And of course, all of that information is very carefully preserved because it is important and much of it is, in fact, used. They would also add about 5,000 new words to the dictionary, which were the words that they felt they had to get in immediately. They weren't all the words that had emerged in the language since the end of the supplement, but something they wanted to get in immediately. And they would convert the phonetic notation that James Murray had developed into the International Phonetic Alphabet. So there would again be consistency, as there is increasingly, across all the major dictionaries in the world. The way this was done was by converting the dictionary to what is called a machine-readable database, and the actual conversion of all of this was in fact the result of research by a couple of graduate students at the University of Waterloo who developed a parser so that they could actually parse the dictionary, take the dictionary apart, and then translate it for these integrative purposes. But it's a real tribute to our students, to higher education in Canada, and certainly to the faculty involved, that a couple of Waterloo graduate students in computer science were able to develop this. That was the first part of the project, to integrate these two parts of the dictionary. The second part was to get the permanent database in place, to get the entire dictionary available in electronic form, and to develop the software, the database management systems, which would allow for continuous upgrading and editing of the dictionary. And this, again, was to be available in 1989, and it was achieved. And then, of course, the press was looking at new products for the 1990s and beyond. An electronic new OED on CD-ROM, which is now available. The ability to generate regional or national dictionaries, which is now possible. Working on a thesaurus. Putting the Word files of the dictionary department on computer, which is something that hasn't happened yet, but something that I hope will, and so on. And you can look at the list of things that they wish to see accomplished by having made this decision to computerize in 1984. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the process, because this is the really, I think, in one sense, the most interesting part of this. And how did a Canadian university get involved in this particular project? When the delegates, as they're called, the directors of Oxford University Press, sat down and tried to decide what to do based on the recommendation from people working at the press, the original intent was to take the whole project and put it out on the commercial market to see if, in this case, it was believed computer companies, companies like IBM or Digital or Wang, might be interested in taking on the whole project of computerizing the dictionary itself. That was the initial intent. OUP did not have the expertise in-house to do this job and didn't think that they could develop the expertise, and thought it made a lot more sense, and you can understand the reason they thought this way, for the experts to be in this business. The fascinating thing about the inquiries that OUP made, both informally and ultimately when they went to tender, was that nobody wanted to take the project on. No one company wanted to take on the entire project. I think there were two reasons for this. There were great uncertainties about it, and that was a worry. But I think in particular, there was the anxiety that you didn't want to be associated with a failure of this scale. To be associated with the contract to computerize the Oxford English Dictionary and then discover that, in fact, you couldn't achieve it was not the sort of commercial mark that any organization would like to be associated with. So that the press, based on their informal soundings and some more formal soundings, recognized that they were going to have to go back to the drawing boards and look at doing this project in another way. In 1983, they issued an invitation to tender, and in May of 1984, they announced what they were going to do. They were not successful in finding that company, as I indicated, so they created their own team within Oxford University Press, a director, 11 lexicographers, 10 computer specialists, and 60 freelance proofreaders who were going to deal with the product as it developed. The project was not in the hands of Robert Birchfield, who had been associated with the dictionary for many, many years, because Dr. Birchfield felt that this was not something that he wished to take on at that particular point in his life. And frankly, he was very hostile to the computer. He did not own a computer. He did not want to own a computer. And he certainly didn't want to be associated with computerizing the Oxford English Dictionary. He believed, as as did many others, that the project was going to fail, and he certainly didn't want to be associated with a failure. So the project ended up being associated with a younger generation at the press, three individuals in particular, two of whom we at Waterloo worked very, very closely with, Edmund Viner, who is now, I guess, about 35, 38, and John Simpson, who is about the same age. These were 10 years ago, obviously much younger individuals given major responsibilities for this project. And again, I want to stress, neither of them knew very much about computing. They did use word processing, but they certainly didn't know anything about the kinds of complexities that they were heading into. The second problem was what to do with the existing text of the OED. Most people assumed that you could take something, which some of you may know, like a Kurzweil reader, scanner, and just scan the dictionary, and that would produce the machine-readable database. Unfortunately, you can't do that with the OED because it has 18 different type fonts. It also, as I indicated, is operating from plates that are worn. And so, in fact, some of the text of the OED is not very clear because the plates have been used so many times. So a variety of efforts, including some at Waterloo, to develop a scanning device to scan the text, which would have been a very quick way to do it, were tried, but none of them would work. It just wouldn't produce the kind of accuracy that the dictionary wanted to have. Therefore, the press contracted with an organization called International Computer Print Corporation, which, to the horror of Mrs. Thatcher, was an American company. And there was a great struggle about whether the British government would provide funding for a project that had a component in the United States. But in the end, they did. They provided a great deal of the funding for this particular project. It took 18 months to rekey the entire dictionary. Some 500 million keystrokes were needed to rekey the entire dictionary on a machine-readable form. And as I indicate, 120 individuals worked full-time on this project for 18 months. They achieved an accuracy that is quite phenomenal. The number of errors per 1,000 or per 10,000 is as low as any project of its kind in the world. IBM UK was involved by providing some of the hardware and a good deal of the software, and three individuals who they loaned to the project for a period of time. But it's, again, significant that they didn't want to take on the contract. No one wanted to take on the contract. And the fourth partner in the project was the University of Waterloo. This is where I was more directly involved and know something about the inside of this particular project. As I said, the president of the University of Waterloo at that time was Dr. Douglas Wright, who just recently retired as president. He had a number of contacts in Oxford and understood that the dictionary project was in the wind. And there had been some discussion in the media about it, but he was quite curious about it. He was also, and there are some in the room who know him, not a person who shrunk from challenges, and a person enormously self-confident about what he and his university could accomplish. So he asked me if I would go to Oxford and sniff around about this project, because I had been a student in Oxford and I had spent a certain amount of time there and I knew some people there. So I went with another colleague in the Department of English to talk to the people at the press and find out a little bit about this project, and we did find out quite a bit about it. And so when the press tendered in 1983, the University of Waterloo put in a proposal. And basically what we proposed at Waterloo was that we would develop, we would work on the computer software side. We would develop the programs that would be needed to achieve this particular project. As I said in my opening remarks, the real people who did all the work were Gaston Gonnet and Frank Tompa, two professors in computer science. Doug Wright had a real problem with the computer science department because they could not understand how this project was researched. And I can remember sitting in the president's office as a fairly junior faculty member, and he working his charms on these individuals and telling them how absolutely central this was, he knew, to the future of research in computing science. And Doug Wright barely knew how to turn on a computer himself at that time. But he was very, very persuasive. He was the president, and there were still some possibilities then that presidents could influence projects. He had the ability to buy people out from their teaching and their research, and he eventually persuaded a number of people, led by Tompa and Gonnet and assisted by me, to take on the project. We had tremendous debates about this project because it didn't seem to have any real challenges, or it didn't seem to be at the cutting edge of research of the kind that was being done in computer science at Waterloo at the time. I was there to try and bring in the arts faculty, to bring in the users of the dictionary, to work with the people in computer science, to suggest the kinds of problems and the kinds of answers we would be looking for if we could get at the dictionary in different ways. I was not particularly well qualified for this task. I certainly use the dictionary, but I'm not in a Department of English, and I'm not a heavy user of the OED on a regular basis. But I had a modest title at that time, and so it was felt that maybe I could assist in this project. And I did gather together a number of people in the humanities and social sciences who became very involved in the project over the time that it was that we were active in it. As indicated at the bottom, we had 8 full-time staff. We had research faculty and graduate students in computer science and the Faculty of Arts working on the project. And I've also indicated where we got the funding, in particular the Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council. What the university saw in this, certainly what Doug Wright saw in it, was, of course, a chance to be associated with a very, very prestigious project. The chance in the end, which has proved absolutely right, that the university would earn significant royalties from the software, and that is indeed happening. And he believed, and he was right, that there were some very important research challenges for this particular project. So we established the Waterloo Center for the New Oxford English Dictionary in the typical university way of creating a center and bringing people together, and got to work on the project. And again, I want to say the people who worked on it were the people in computer science, not me, and not most of the people in the Faculty of Arts. I put this up before we started so you could get a little bit of sense of what we're dealing with. This is not the way the OED looks when you look at it. Of course, we've highlighted the various sections so you can see some of the complexity of the dictionary. But this is an entry for the word ladder. And it is not all the entries, it's just the beginning of the entry for the word ladder. But there are a number of distinguishing characteristics for this entry, and if you're a computer scientist, this suddenly starts to look interesting because it's organized. And it's organized in a very, very efficient way. And what we discovered, and in particular what people in computer science discovered, was that James Murray, he may have been an eccentric, and he certainly was in many ways, he was a very organized individual. And when he put together the dictionary, he did it in an extraordinarily systematic way. Every entry is done exactly the same way. So in fact, we began to see it as a database in waiting. It was really there. And the language became very flowery. It simply needed the computer's kiss to lift it out of the text and become a database. I don't know about that, but in any event, It was there, and it is an extremely well-organized dictionary if you sit down and study it. Again, very few of us do so, except those who are involved in this area for teaching or research purposes. But Murray deserves a lot of credit. What have we got here? Some of you know more about this than I do, so I'll be very careful. But up at the top, we have the etymology of the word. It's trying to what we're looking at here is where it comes from. The derivations from Kent, from Old Frisian, from Old English, from Middle Dutch, from Dutch. These are all the variants: Old High German, Middle High German, Greek. All of this is common to every entry of the dictionary, the etymology of the word, and they try again. Murray and his colleagues tried to develop a very systematic way of looking at it so you could see the evolution historically. And it is, of course, a historic dictionary. So you work through the etymologies, and then you come to the first definition, or lemma. And you can read the definition as well as I can. And then the next distinguishing feature of the dictionary is, of course, the quotations. And this is where the dictionary is the most fun for those of us who like to roam around in dictionaries. Because what they try to do is provide a quotation for every century and do it again chronologically. So in this case, I can't read that, but I know there are a couple of people who can, beginning with a 10th century quotation and working all the way through, right up to Charles Dickens from the Old Curiosity Shop, Kit mounted halfway up a short ladder. That's the great richness of the dictionary, are these voluminous record of quotations trying to illustrate, in this case, the particular sense of ladder, which is the sense that we understand a ladder, or we might initially think about a ladder, but as I say, there are a number of other definitions for ladder. Which would not be as familiar to us, and they would be set out in exactly the same way. So the challenge was, how are you going to get this material in the one text, the 12 volumes of the dictionary, and the 4 volumes of the supplement? The first challenge is, how are you going to integrate that? Because if you go to ladder in the supplement, you find additional information about ladder, new meanings, better quotations, etc., etc. So the first thing is as it were, to take all those slips of paper, cut them all up, and put them together. Well, we weren't going to do that. It was all going to be done on a computer. But that was the first challenge. Commercially, that was the thing Oxford had to have happen. They had to get a database that integrated the supplements and the original dictionary itself. The result, published in 1989, published that way, was what is formally known as the Oxford English Dictionary 2. Published in 1989, 20 volumes, etc., etc. Slightly larger than the combination of the original dictionary and the supplement because of, for example, the addition of 5,000 new and more quotations, and a much more accurate text. This is the first product of this collaboration between these various partners, Waterloo, OUP, and so on. It's very traditional, but it is the dictionary brought together in a way that had not occurred in the past. It has sold well, this version. I've even gone and found my name in it. I'm so excited to be associated with the Oxford English Dictionary. It's way down there, but it's there. Oxford's very satisfied with this. It's achieved one of the major objectives that they wanted. I make an interesting observation. If you imagined where this big dictionary would be sold, the biggest demand for this dictionary, geographically, I think you might be surprised to know that the largest purchasing country of Oxford English Dictionaries is Japan. There are more copies of the Oxford English Dictionary in terms of a single country in Japan than anywhere else, including England, the United States, and so on. And that proved true with this second version of the OED. Now, not many of us have $3,125 Canadian to go down to our neighborhood bookstore and pick up this dictionary. So many of us want to use it in other versions. And that is, of course, what the promise of this whole project was, that we could get at the dictionary in new ways. So there are some CD-ROM versions. The first one was published, and again, this is in this case a CD-ROM version of the original OED. So this is the old dictionary with the supplement, the 12 volumes plus the supplement, published in a CD-ROM version, a computerized version, in 1989-90 for $1,250 U.S. Then the second dictionary, which is the integrated dictionary, was published in the next year for $895 U.S. And as those of you who've used the dictionary or who have access to it know, it runs on the Windows and it also runs now on a Mac version. So it's fairly accessible for most people in a computing environment. And of course, it's online as well. And some of our libraries are starting to buy it now for general usage. Now, one of the questions is, oh, this is all very wonderful. What can you do with it? What are the opportunities that one might have if you could, in fact, have the OED, the associated software, on a CD-ROM on your PC, which is now possible? What could you do? Well, there are a whole bunch of things you could do, and I'll put up a list of a few of them. This all began by a number of us thinking, well, we could use it to play Scrabble, right? This is clearly an important issue for some people. If we had this, you could solve all your Scrabble problems. In fact, it's pretty difficult to use it to play Scrabble. I've not tried, but I know people who have. But there is a list of a few things that you could do with the dictionary, and I'll give you some more precise illustrations. You could certainly pull up all the quotations by Peter Nemetz. You could pull up all the quotations dated 1772 in the dictionary. You could pull up all the quotations attributed to the Bible or whatever. You could list a whole variety of quotations with one or more given strings. You could search the etymologies, the things that I had up before. You can search by phonetic spelling. In other words, you can approximate the spelling and find words. You could use the OED as a reverse dictionary, working from the definition backwards. You could discover usage of terms in new fields, and so on. I won't read you the list. You can read just as well as I can. What I was very interested in as a historian was trying to get at the influence in the development of the British Empire, and in particular the influence of India on language of empire. And you could now start to do some of that through the OED. I haven't had time to try it yet. What I really wanted to do was get at the record, the original material that's stored at the OED and find more in that area. But you could do that. And you can certainly produce a dictionary of Australian English or a dictionary of Caribbean English, whatever country you want to do. You can actually generate that right now with the database as it now stands. There are other things you can do. Some of these are repeats, but some of them are different. These require further revisions, and some of these have now, they're now feasible. You can do them. Others, more work needs to be done. Again, I won't read it to you. Okay, now, I'm sure people are always interested in a few particulars. Here are a few. The Premier of Ontario, Bill Davis, Bland Bill, as he was known, came to the University of Waterloo when we were in the middle of this project to open the, surprise, surprise, William Davis Building at the University of Waterloo. That it was named after him after he retired as premier, but I'm sure it helped in getting a little money for the building. In any event, he was coming to visit the building, and he became interested in the dictionary and in the dictionary project. So he came into the center, and we said, it can do all these wonderful things. So he said, well, let's see if there's anything in the dictionary for William Davis. So we typed in W. Davis without knowing what would happen. And the word ridership came up. And the word ridership is, in fact, attributed to Bill Davis. He wasn't then the Premier of Ontario. He was involved in municipal politics in metropolitan Toronto, and he was looking at transportation issues and issued some report. And somebody saw this word, somebody who was probably irritated by this word in Toronto, wrote to the dictionary and said, here's some fool using a word that I don't know what it means. I always thought it was attributed to riding horses. In this case, it was, of course, the ridership of public transportation. And Bill Davis has a quotation in the Oxford English Dictionary. He was very, very happy. David Peterson, who was the premier at the time, Bill Davis had retired, Peterson came. Peterson wanted to see if his name in the dictionary. He wasn't in the dictionary. It was not a good visit. Shakespeare. Everybody wants to know about Shakespeare. How many quotations attributed to Shakespeare in the OED? Just shy of 33,000. So you could print. And you could, right now, with the way it's set up, print a dictionary with all the vocabulary that was available to Shakespeare at the time that Shakespeare was writing. That is now possible. What is the word for a battle of mice and frogs? You could solve that problem if it was bothering you with the CD-ROM version of the OED and the software written by my friends at Waterloo. You could also determine that there are 25 Albanian roots or cognates in the OED, and you could do, in many cases, the PhD work that took years in minutes. For example, tracing the influence of Old French in the English language. We saw somebody do that in the Dictionary Center. They'd been working on this for years. They came in, sat down with a little coaching. They were able to generate lists of words they'd never seen. They were turning the pages of the dictionary one page at a time, reading through the dictionary. It's the only way to do that kind of research. Now you can do it very quickly. The area that is of particular interest to a number of people in the social sciences, and in particular in psychology, but also reaching across, because cognitive science moves across a number of disciplines, and one that I'm quite persuaded eventually will be very, very important for people working with the dictionary, is how we acquire language skills. It's a very, very complex area. It's not something I'm competent to lecture on. But there is a general belief that the availability of a database like this, the right kinds of questions being asked, and the right manipulation, and I'm sure there are people here in the audience who would know more about it, that this is a very, very powerful tool for the cognitive scientists, people working in cognitive science. Now, a couple of more whimsical things. I'm sure you all want to know, since you're at UBC, how often Simon Fraser appears in the OED. This is not all the entries. I didn't want to overwhelm you. But there's a certain consistency to what they're citing. Nearly all, of course, the 14th century. But there is a curious one, Yon Thief of the Black Midnight, Simon Fraser, from something by Stevenson. I looked for UBC, but it was too much to print. No, there are no direct references that I could find. And of course, we're all vain, so we want to see whether we're cited. This is not the same J. Stubbs. But there are 23 citations for J. Stubbs. None of them are for me, but in any event, it's kind of fun just to see. It gives you an idea of what you can do. Did you get it, finally? Okay. Now, finally, I wanted just to show you that although I'm a president, I'm still trying to keep up with my research. So I contacted people at Waterloo and at Oxford just to find out what's going on right now with this particular project. And let me just, as I end the lecture, say a few things that are going on. The center at the University of Waterloo still exists. It is moved on from this project because, in fact, Waterloo finished what it was asked to do and did it very, very well. So the center now is very much focused on looking at other large text databases. They've been working with other dictionaries in other languages. They've been working with encyclopedias. A good deal of work is being done with encyclopedias at the present time and directories. They're also trying to earn a little money, so they're working with procedural manuals and policy manuals and so on. There is still support for scholars who want to go to the Waterloo Center. Unfortunately, there's no more money for entertaining visiting scholars, which was something we were privileged to do for 5 years. With the resources we had. But there are lots and lots of people visiting the center, and I know there's a great deal of activity. Waterloo, the center has been very much involved in the new shorter Oxford English Dictionary, which was recently published. The center played quite a key role in developing some of the software and some of the supporting database work that was done for that project. In the research field, there is a great deal of activity in the area of hypertext. And there was a very nice write-up in the Vancouver Sun today about hypertext. So if you don't know what that is, run back and you can read it in the Sun. And they are very active as well in a project that we talked about there in the early days, and that is linking other texts. It will soon be possible for all the Oxford dictionaries to be linked. All the various historic Oxford dictionaries that a number of you will know. And this is the sad part I have to report. Being a Waterloo project, a company was spun out of this. Had I stayed there, I might have been a shareholder in this company, which is called the Open Text Corporation. And I can assure you it's doing very well. They had a big display ad in the Globe this week for more employees. So they're doing very, very well. So I think it is important, and I want to be lighthearted about it. But on the other side, I want to say that this was a very, very important research project in terms of moving ahead in a variety of areas. But it's also a very applied project. And in fact, a goodly number of people have now found employment as a result of this project. A very successful company has been spun out of the project, and that continues to benefit the University of Waterloo very directly through a variety of means, one of which is employment for co-op students. Oxford University Press itself continues to work on the project. Their main objective in terms of the OED that I've been talking about is to produce a third edition of the OED in the year 2005. As I said, they really do think ahead at Oxford, and so they're very much preparing for that particular project. There are now 19 in-house lexicographers, so that area has grown at the press, and they are developing, obviously, a range of spin-off dictionaries from the original project. And they are reporting to people about the project through the publication of a series of volumes called the OED Edition Series, presents new work in progress from across the alphabetic range by the editorial, this is a plug, by the editorial team of the Oxford English Dictionary. Each edition's volume will supplement the second edition of the OED by providing complete entries for new or newly researched words and definitions, quotations, and dating for new senses of existing words. They're publishing one volume, I think it'll almost be annually on this until the third edition of the OED emerges in 2005. I believe also, although I'm not sure, that they are trying to get more and more of this online so that people can get access to this through various databases. So, in conclusion, I've told you a story. I think it's a very interesting story. It's a story where certainly one Canadian university played a very prominent role. I think it's something that we should celebrate. It's also, I think, very, very interesting for the way it brought together a range of disparate partners. It would be pretty well inconceivable, I think, for anyone to imagine 15 years ago that somehow Oxford University, one of the old Oxford University Press, as part of one of the oldest and most distinguished universities in the world, would end up in a major partnership with a Canadian university. But in fact, it happened. And it was a very, very successful partnership. And as I say, I think it did all the things that universities should be doing. It was, in fact, a research project of great complexity. It allowed for a very considerable advancement of knowledge in a number of fields. It has opened up a whole range of other fields for users of the dictionary, and it has also generated a real return for the University of Waterloo and also for Oxford University Press. So thank you very much for listening to my story.
There is an opportunity now to ask questions of our speaker.
I think so.
Would it take great skill or talent?
No, I don't think so. I'm hesitant because I should have said, but I think you realize I've been away from the project intensely for 6 or 7 years, so I can't answer the question with absolute precision. But my sense is no. I think that problem would be solvable relatively easily.
I have about three questions, but I'm putting them in rapid succession. First of all, I believe corresponding work by the French Academy has not reached anything like
that's correct. Right. The question was the fact that the French have not had as great success in moving in this direction with their major dictionary. Was this a problem for the OED project? There were certainly difficulties with this. There were, I know, and I don't know the intimate details, there were certainly conversations with the press's colleagues in France during this project, and there have been, I think, fairly continuous conversations about whether or not there are ways that they could work together on certain aspects of the project. But it's a question that I think only the people at the press could tell you in detail.
The shorter, is that OED?
The question is the shorter OED on CD-ROM? I don't think it is yet, but I believe it is planned to be. But again, I'm a little out of touch.
And also the supplements.
Yes. Yes, I think so. Yes.
You spoke of national and regional dictionaries. Would you elaborate on that? And in particular, what does that mean for Canada?
The question is national and regional dictionaries, and in particular, what would that mean for Canada? Would it be, I think by implication, would it be possible to develop regional dictionaries? There is a very famous project, I'm sure some people in the room will know about it, called the Dictionary of American, DARE, Dictionary of American Regional English. And we had a lot of contact with the individuals who were involved in that particular project. And the dictionary as set up in this current structure would allow for, as I say, the development of a crude dictionary of Australian terms in the OED or West Indian terms or more particular than that, I'm not sure. And I don't know within the Canadian context whether the citations would go anything beyond Canada, whether we have the ability at this point to be more focused. You could obviously draw out Quebecois references, but whether you could then generate a regional dictionary from that, I don't know. There's lots and lots of material about Canada in the OED. It's quite remarkable.
I'm a fan of reading the dictionary.
Right.
I have a magnifying lamp. I like to put the squint edition down and look at it. Is it possible with this new edition to display on the computer screen an actual replica of the text?
The question is, could you display on a computer screen a replica of the font, of the text? I don't think so, Lee, but I'm not sure. I don't think so. I didn't see it when we were playing around with it anyway. It's very close. They try to be as close as possible for the very reasons that are being suggested in the question, because it's very appealing for those who are interested in typefaces and the way it's organized. So they tried to move as close as possible to the original text.
So they did special
purpose. Oh yes. Yes, absolutely. Yes. Yep. Right. On the CD version, it's one. It's available in one. Yes?
You said there's an online, this is accessible online, is it the address?
No. But I'm out of touch, but my understanding is that there is one where you can pick it up. I know there is. Right. Sorry, I don't have it on the tip of my tongue.
I found one at Stanford, but I was unable to read it.
Online?
There is one online at Stanford, which can be read at Stanford, evidently, but I'm unable to read it.
Hmm.
You don't know?
No, I don't. Sorry.
Back at the back? Yeah.
something that is a super Swiftian satire on the folly of 18th century France, without specifically English. And I have trouble that I don't speak French. So I have to keep, I speak in French like a Frenchman while I speak English. And when they have these translations, I mean, the side has become canonical in France. But from what I've heard, Tom Jones was censored at the time in France.
Right.
And so weird. I don't know how to tell.
Right.
You have an office or a facility that accepts occasional contributions. Somebody in famous audience has found that uses in West Coast poetry rather consistent but localized,
mm-hmm.
and then they submit
yes.
a small number of lexical items and the quotations.
Yes, the question is, would something from this area, say local West Coast poetry or usage, be of interest to the dictionary? It would be. You write to the dictionary department, Oxford University Press, Oxford.
So basically anybody in the
Absolutely.
Assembly or
others
could...
Absolutely.
Oh,
absolutely. They're delighted to hear from you. A lot of them were sold as a way to raise money. I've got four. Each of us got four. I was going to bring one, but holding it up here, I'm sure you'd all be thrilled to see me standing with a piece of metal. But we all of us who were involved got them. But then they were sold, and some were melted down as well. Yes. No, I don't. But there were a lot, and they weigh a lot. Oh, no, good question. Good question. I've been waiting for the question, as it were, about who's the guardian here, because, as you know, in the French language, to get a word into the accepted officially is a very elaborate process. That's a really interesting question, and how do you get a word into the OED, or a sense, or a quotation? I thought that there would be some rather hierarchical structure at the press, or involving, distinguished colleagues at the university who would decide how these things get in. In point of fact, the decisions are made by the editor. So Bob Birchfield, for 30 years, decided what got in and what didn't get in. So if you see a slight tilting toward New Zealand references, and you could now search that, of course, to see whether there was a little bit of an inclination, as he was a New Zealander. But now the work is done by Edmund Viner and John Simpson. And I've traveled with them. I traveled across the Atlantic one time. And it was amazing to watch them, because they would pick up... they had Newsweek, and they had Time, and they had Maclean's. And they don't read like the rest of us read. They have a sort of magic marker, and they circle all these words and rip them out and put them in their briefcases, and then they do make the decisions. And they clearly discuss among themselves as lexicographers how the entry will be put together, or how it will be amended. But the decisions are basically made by, in this case, two individuals really. And I think, many people were amazed. I certainly was amazed to discover that. I didn't realize that's how it's done. So, but they are people, as you might imagine, of enormous curiosity. I mean, they are so, that nothing is, there isn't anything that isn't of interest to them. I mean, they just want to know about everything. And they're delightful people to spend time with. Really very, very interesting. Right. I can't answer the question. I presume it will continue to flourish. It seems to do very, very well, but I don't know the answer to that question.
You sort of faced yourself in the discussion. You never really found out what you did.
All right. The question is, you know, what role does the historian, in this case, this historian, play in this project? I want to be very honest about it. I was asked because I knew people in Oxford, and that was how I got involved. I lived one door from the president in Waterloo, and of course that's how the world goes around. I was the associate dean for special programs in the Faculty of Arts, and one of the things I really was asked to do was try to assemble within our university and beyond, as it were, a representative sample of users of the dictionary so that we could quiz our colleagues in computer science and we could help them understand some of the problems that we might have in wanting to use the dictionary. I use the OED a bit, but I don't use it a lot in my own work as a historian. I'm a modern historian. My interests are in the 20th century. And so, in some senses, the dictionary, until this version, was somewhat limiting for me. But that was really my job, to get people together, to get them interested in the project. I want to say that, of course, what happened is our colleagues in computer science became probably the two most knowledgeable lexicographers in Canada as a result of working on this project. They are enormously bright individuals, and they really began to run circles around us as they learned more and more about how dictionaries are put together. We learned, obviously, some things from them, but I want to give them the credit. I went out and raised some of the money, too. I'm not bad at doing that, but they did the work. They did the work.
One more question.
If I had the OED on CD-ROM, and I wanted to have a file of the words of a certain sort, say all words less than 8 characters in length,
yes,
on floppy disk,
yes,
could I do that and take them away from other users?
Yes. No, you could do that. Question is, could you develop lists of particular things for your own personal use? No, there would be no problem with that. Obviously, if you're going to commercial use, you'd hear from Oxford about it. And that's the endless concern, of course, is the pirating. Yes, that's correct. Yes, that's right.
Before I ask Patricia Graham from the Vancouver Sun to speak, to thank our speaker, two announcements. The lecture next week is Privatizing Russia, speaker from Harvard University, and should be quite an interesting one in the light of recent developments. And the dinner honoring UBC's Nobel Prize winner, Michael Smith, which was scheduled for mid-February, has been postponed until April, and there'll be more announcements about that later. As those of you who are members of the Institute know, when you received your program, you saw there was to be a dinner sponsored by the Vancouver Institute and a number of other local organizations for Michael Smith, but that has been postponed now. I'd like to ask our sponsor for the evening, Vancouver Sun, Patricia Graham, to thank the speaker.
Thank you. It's a privilege and a pleasure for me to thank Dr. Stubbs for what really was quite a fascinating story. We in the newspaper business learn that there are several issues that tend to push people's buttons. Politics, of course, somewhat more surprisingly, animals, and these days anything to do with gender or racial issues. But in the last 2 years, probably nothing the Vancouver Sun has done has engendered more controversy than our decision to replace the word fisherman with the word fisher. That biblical resurrection is usually attributed to me, and depending on whom I'm talking to, I may or may not take credit for it, but I suspect several people have written to the dictionary, and perhaps someday I'll find my name in there. So thank you very much, Dr. Stein.